ring into there. But I do think, as Ty said, you see it starting to fragment, and whether or not people in these coming cycles are going to keep pouring it all into TV ads on network affiliates, I'm not sure it's going to be the same mm-hmm. way. It's like polling with cell phones, right?
Yeah. We are just about out of time. We heard the races Carl's watching. Which ones are you watching until the election day?
I think Iowa and Colorado are the two biggest ones. I'm personally covering the North Carolina race. I've been covering it for the last year. So I'm interested in seeing what happens there. But I think it is going to come down to Iowa and Colorado.
And South Dakota and Kansas are just really fascinating
now.
And South Dakota particularly.
As Ty Mastar said, this one is turning out to be something of a political junkies field.
Yeah.
So thanks to both of you for being here this week.
Thank you.
Appreciate
thanks.
It.
Be part of C-SPAN's Campaign 2014 coverage. Follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook to get debate schedules, video clips of key moments, debate previews from our politics team. C-SPAN is bringing you over 100 Senate, House, and Governor debates, and you can instantly share your reactions to what the candidates are saying. The battle for control of Congress. Stay in touch and engage by following us on Twitter at C-SPAN and liking us on Facebook at facebook.com/C-SPAN.
On the next Washington Journal, FreedomWorks president and CEO Matt Kibbe talks about the influence of the Tea Party in the 2014 midterm elections. Dale Ho from the American Civil Liberties Union will discuss recent court rulings on voting rules that may impact several key Senate and governor's races. And The Hill healthcare reporter Elise Vebeck looks at the administration's handling of Ebola cases in the U.S. As always, we'll take your calls, and you can join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Washington Journal, live at 7 a.m. Eastern on C-SPAN. World Bank President Jim Yong Kim called for international financial help to fight the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. He spoke at the International Monetary Fund World Bank annual meeting Thursday in Washington. This is 25 Minutes.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming to the press conference to open the 2014 World Bank Group IMF annual meetings. Dr. Kim will give an opening statement, then we'll take questions from you. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the 2014 World Bank Group IMF annual meetings. I've got three topics that I'd like to talk about, and then I'll take your questions. I've just come from a meeting focused on the Ebola epidemic, and we had an extremely productive discussion. We had President Conde from Guinea with us, and we had President Johnson Sirleaf and President Karoma on video conference. They not only addressed us, they made extremely specific requests based on what they need now in the countries to focus the response. The crisis we know could have an enormous impact. Just yesterday, we gained a better understanding of the potential economic damage from the outbreak. The World Bank Group released a new economic impact assessment that said if the epidemic is not quickly contained and if it spreads to neighboring countries, the two-year regional financial impact could reach U.S. $32.6 billion by the end of 2015. That would be catastrophic for the people of the West Africa region. One of the things that Secretary of State of the Department for International Development of the United Kingdom, Justine Greening, pointed out was that every day that we don't invest, every day that we don't put money into stopping the crisis is many, many more dollars and pounds that we're going to have to use later. It is an extremely good investment right now to prevent this kind of loss, to put all the money on the table right now to get the response going. The World Health Organization's just estimated that Liberia alone, for example, needs 360 foreign medical staff today to treat those infected. Now, one of the sticking points of getting foreign medical staff into these three countries has been the lack of medical evacuation. We heard this morning from the European Commission and from the United States that both of those groups have now committed to medically evacuating health workers and other workers, the responders. This has been a major roadblock, and now with the announcement this morning, I think that we're on a much better path to be able to staff the response. Second subject, now, and I'd be happy to talk more about the other outcomes of that meeting. The second subject involves infrastructure. Today, I'll be launching a new partnership initiative, the Global Infrastructure Facility, which is aimed at mobilizing the private sector to help tackle the massive infrastructure deficit now facing developing countries and emerging markets. We estimate that these countries need $1 trillion a year in extra investment through 2020. The Global Infrastructure Facility, known as the GIF, represents a unique collaboration among the private sector, especially institutional investors, donor nations, multilateral development banks, and the World Bank Group, to help unlock billions of dollars for infrastructure projects in developing and emerging economies. With public purses stretched, it's significant that the heads of some of the world's leading institutional investors will be signing up as partners in the GIF. Institutional investors have deep pockets. Insurance and pension funds have some $80 trillion in assets, but less than 1% of pension funds are allocated directly to infrastructure projects, and the bulk of that is in advanced countries. We've been hearing loud and clear that the money's out there. The real challenge is not a matter of money, but a lack of bankable projects, a sufficient supply of commercially viable and sustainable infrastructure investments. The GIF is a new concept that can be piloted quickly and does not require tens of billions in new resources. The aim is to crowd in the tens of billions or more, potentially, that's now sitting on the sidelines waiting for good investments, and we can bring those investments off the sidelines by addressing issues like risk. My third topic involves the fight against cholera in Haiti. Today, the World Bank Group is pledging $50 million to help improve access to safe water and sanitation for all Haitians, aimed at preventing waterborne diseases. Later, I'll be chairing a conference with the United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon with the objective of raising even more donor funds. Thank you very much, and now I'll take your questions.
Okay, so please identify yourself and your organization. Have the woman in the back there. Is there a microphone? Okay.
Thank you. Sun Zhou from China Business News. Dr. Kim, I have a question on AIIB, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. What is your comment on AIIB's business model compared to the existing institutions such as the World Bank and the ADB? And do you think the AIIB can collaborate effectively with the ADB and the World Bank, but without to avoid fragmentation? Thank you.
Well, my understanding is that the AIIB, the business model, is still being discussed. There are many different issues that are still to be worked out. I've made it very clear from the very beginning of discussions around AIIB that we think that we can be a very, very strong partner for AIIB. You know, for example, we have 70 years of experience doing project preparation, helping with implementation, supervision, and also we think that the safeguards that we bring to the table in any project will be helpful in reducing risk for investors. I mean, this is really a major concern of all investors, that they do not want to they do not want to suffer the reputational damage that will happen if environmental and social safeguards are not respected. So I think that we've already been in very close discussions with leaders in both the AIIB and the New Development Bank, the BRICS Bank, and our intention and our expectation is that we'll be working very closely. You know, at the World Bank Group, our enemy is poverty. And just as I, you know, have said, there is such a need for more investment in infrastructure that any organization that's focused on investing in infrastructure to fight poverty is our friend.
Next question. Okay. Right there.
Thank you. Anthony Rowley, Emerging Markets. On the GIF, the World Bank has progressively withdrawn from infrastructure over a long period, and a great deal of the expertise that used to exist in the bank in everything from engineering and finance presumably is no longer there. So does this mean that the bank is now going to staff up again with the kind of people who specialize in infrastructure?
Well, we still actually do have quite a large portfolio in infrastructure projects. I think it's a relatively smaller proportion of the overall portfolio than it was, say, decades ago. On the other hand, we did over $60 billion in business last year. As we scale up our global practices, our groups that are specifically focused on particular areas, if we need to bring in more experts on roads and energy and transport, we'll do so. But we are already doing quite a bit of work in infrastructure. The platform, though, is very important in a new sense. Is that as we start putting projects together, it will be people from the World Bank who have expertise, but we'll also be able to draw on expertise from the other multilateral development banks, and importantly, also from the private sector. So this is a platform to bring together the expertise to take what we know are bankable projects, but that without the kind of project preparation that will make it clear that they're bankable projects, investments won't flow. So we're looking forward to drawing on expertise from all over the world, but also from inside the World Bank Group.
Okay. I'll take in the back there.
Yep. Dr. Kim, sir. Your projection is to ensure that...
Just identify yourself, please.
Sir. I am Cliff. I observe NTN News Nigeria. So sub-Saharan Africa is projected to grow at above 5%, with some country like Nigeria growing above 6%. And we know too well that a whole lot is passing on. I don't know to the extent the growth rate is impacting on the efforts of World Bank to encourage countries to end extreme poverty. Thank you.
I'm not sure what the question was. I'm sorry.
Okay. What I'm saying is, given the impressive growth rate in sub-Saharan Africa, to what extent is it impacting on the efforts to end abject poverty?
The question is, to what extent is the growth rate in Africa impacting poverty? Okay. This is an important question. You know, in 1990, the number of people living in extreme poverty in East Asia and in Africa was about the same, 55% or so. In East Asia, that has dropped tremendously over that period of time to less than 10%. But in Africa, it's remained at 46%. And so one of the things that has been a bit of a disappointment is that poverty rates have remained high despite high growth rates. And so very specifically, in Africa, we were working with countries to ensure that these high growth rates are translated into lowering levels of extreme poverty. For example, many African countries have had new discoveries of natural resources, minerals, oil, for example. And what we know in so many cases, these discoveries don't lead to direct benefits for the poorest. And so this is one of our most important priorities. We want to ensure that we work with African countries to take these new, wonderful, important discoveries of mineral wealth, of oil wealth, and translate that into reduced levels of poverty. I can tell you that every one of the ministers of finance I speak with in Africa are very committed to reducing extreme poverty and making sure that that prosperity is shared. We need to just provide the kind of technical expertise, the solutions from around the world that will help them do that.
And the purple here.
Thank you. I'm Jennifer Lee with Hong Kong Phoenix TV. I have a question regarding Ebola. So in your remarks, you mentioned the new assessment of the financial impact regionally. I wonder, can you elaborate more on that? And also, in which aspect you see there might be a spillover effects over the world? Thank you.
One of the things we did, our economists were looking at what were the impacts economically in previous epidemics, and one of the ones we looked at was SARS. And what we learned is that the impact of SARS, which was a tragic outbreak, 800 deaths, but the overall economic impact was far greater than just the impact of the virus. It was $46 billion. And the impact, 80 to 90% of the economic impact, is not from the virus itself. It's from the aversion behavior, the fear factor that surrounds an outbreak. Now, what we know is that the one thing that will stop that aversion behavior and lessen the economic impact is to have systems in place so that responses are quick and effective. So one of the things we talked about this morning is that we now know exactly what it will take not only to stop the virus, but stop the aversion behavior that leads to this huge economic impact. And that's really good news in a sense, that doing the right thing, you know, not only identifying cases, doing safe burials, but providing treatment for the people who are ill, and doing it even at the community-based level, which is what was called for today, all those things are the right thing to do for the Liberian, Guinean, and Sierra Leonean people. It's the right thing to do to prevent the spread from a public health perspective, and it's also the right thing to do to stop the fear that causes the enormous economic impacts. So this morning what we did was everyone redoubled their commitment to acting right now to get those adequate treatment, prevention, identification systems in place on the ground in those three countries. And this is a point that we really want to make. Are there other spillover effects? Well, we are hearing that with the two workers who died in Spain, plus the maybe one or two new infections that have happened, that we're already seeing an economic impact, that the stock value of travel companies, of airlines, have already taken a hit. And I can tell you that that will continue unless we get the adequate response in place in those three countries. You have to stop these epidemics at the source. Trying to block your borders or isolating those countries somehow is not going to work. So I was encouraged this morning, but there's still a lot of work to do. And one of the messages that came out very strongly is if anybody, any country, any private sector group would like to make a contribution, they should do it now, not wait 2 or 3 weeks, because the price tag goes up every day that we delay.
Behind Larry, the person back there. Yeah.
Hi, Andrew Maeda from Bloomberg News. Dr. Kim, can you just clarify the $32.6 billion, what geography that covers? Does that cover Western Africa, or is that?
Yeah, it's Western Africa. It's Western Africa and the surrounding countries. I can give you a list of okay. Exactly what countries. Ghana, Senegal, Cote d'Ivoire, and it's looking at what will happen if the cases begin to spread. And the thing, the point that we were making is that right now, as long as it's not under control, let me put it this way. So right now, because we don't have adequate treatment services, and you know when. If you think about it from the perspective of a person from Guinea, Sierra Leone, or Liberia, right? The public health imperative is to stop the spread, but the human imperative, the individual human imperative, is to get treatment. So the incentive right now is to go wherever you need to go to get treatment so you can live. Right now, we don't have the services in place so that the first thought of the people from those three countries is, I need to go to my local clinic because I know they'll take care of me effectively. So that's what we need to do. Now, the presumption of the $32.6 billion is that things get delayed and delayed and delayed, And the people inside those countries do the rational thing for themselves and try to find care elsewhere. That's where the real impact is going to happen. If we see this kind of impact already with two, maybe four cases in Spain, we know that historically this aversion behavior, this fear factor, can spread very quickly.
To clarify, do you have a global figure at this point?
Not yet.
Okay, we're going to take just time for two more questions. In the back there.
Thank you. Michael Igo with DevEx. Dr. Kim, on Tuesday, you held a sort of improvised town hall meeting to hear concerns and questions from staff about the ongoing reforms at the World Bank Group. What was your biggest takeaway from that meeting, and do you expect that it will lead to any concrete changes in either the implementation or communication of your reforms? And then, sorry, just a quick second question. You're undergoing a strategic staffing exercise to map staff to the global practices. How do you know where expertise will be required before you've seen demand for your services under the new organizational structure? Thank you.
Thanks, Michael. First of all, we're undergoing the most thorough, ambitious reorganization in close to 20 years. So it's not a surprise to me that there's anxiety, that there's concern. More than anything, what the staff were saying was that they wanted to talk to me directly. They wanted to tell me, what the problems are that they were seeing. And I was aware of some of them. There were some that were new to me. But we had an extremely good discussion. And my takeaway from that, the most important takeaway, and the thing that kept coming up is that they want to talk to me more. So we'll have another town hall next week, and we'll do as many as we need until people feel that they're being heard. Now, this is what happens when you try to reorganize a multilateral institution. I've done reorganizations before, but the complexity of this institution is just enormous. There's 188 member governments. We work in many, many different languages. We work in so many different countries. So I'm not surprised, but I would also point out, look at all the things that we've already gotten done. For example, we have been able to double the capacity for our lending to middle-income countries. We have had a record IDA replenishment last year. Already, the global practices are providing information and support, for example, to Prime Minister Modi in India, that caused him to tweet out immediately after my meeting that they don't need our money, but we're going to be their information bank. And the reason is because we were able to provide him such interesting insights into how we can bring solutions to his problem. So there are a lot of good things about it already, but anytime you undertake something this enormous, you're going to have these kind of problems. Now, in terms of strategic staffing, we know a lot from what we've already been doing. So we have some ideas about the kinds of staff that we will need and we won't need. But what I would like to stress is that the expenditure review we're going through, strategic staffing, all this is stuff that you have to do as an organization no matter what. And we haven't done it. We haven't been doing it for quite a few years. So when you start the process of asking questions like, so what are we spending on different things? Are we spending the same amount to do something here as we're doing over there? When you're asking those questions for the first time, it is really tough to go through. But it's just something that every organization should go through. Every organization should ask itself, do we have the right staff? And are we fit for purpose for what we're trying to do? I am glad that we've done it, and we'll continue. And the good news is that we're almost done. We're going to be finished soon.
Okay. I'm looking for some gender balance view.
Thank you, John. Thank you so much, Esther Zoying with China Central TV. On the Chinese economic slowdown, it has now almost been a year after the Chinese government carried out a slew of measures in order to make the country's economy more stable. So what is your evaluation on those reforms that has been carried out so far, and how would you interpret the slowdown? Do you take them as cyclical changes, or do you take them as the changes brought by those reforms? Thank you.
So China is trying to undergo a massive change in their growth model. And this is something that my predecessor, Bob Zelik, I think worked truly brilliantly with the Chinese government over several years to put together a plan called China 2030. So if your intention, you know, China going from some of the highest investment rates that we've ever seen, you know, 46% of GDP, and then to try to pivot to a growth strategy that's much more focused on consumption and services, to try to sort of move up the value chain, if you will, in terms of economic productivity, this is a very difficult thing to do. And so we have been watching very carefully, and there has been a slowdown from traditional rates of, you know, very high growth rates of 10%. And I think the important thing as we watch is that China continues to be committed to that reform process. We believe that that reform process and moving toward a different growth model is what China needs to do. And so it's a very delicate balance. They have to, on the one hand, be ready to move to a different growth model, but on the other hand, try to keep growth rates up because you need the growth for new jobs, new entrants on the market. We have faith in Chinese leadership. We think that they very clearly understand these trade-offs, and we will continue to work very closely with them. For example, one of the things that after the China 2030 report, the Chinese government has continued to ask us to help them solve their most difficult problems. So last year we launched a report on urbanization. And as an example of what our global practices now are able to do, our many different global practices got together and said, what are the best models in the world and in China for how China can handle the next 300 million people who are coming into the cities? China will be the first country in the world that has 1 billion urban dwellers. And so we looked at everything from how to reform the hukou system, how to provide health and education in the cities, how to provide clean energy, how to increase the density of cities so that we lower the carbon footprint. And China is now already undertaking the recommendations that we came together jointly to provide. Right now, we're working on an assessment and a plan for their healthcare system. China spends already 5% of GDP, which is a huge amount, but are not happy with the amount of health improvement that they're getting for this expenditures. This is so healthy for a country to be able to say, we want to do better in a particular area. And we think that if we can help them to make the most of their current expenditures and make those expenditures as efficient as possible so that we actually have healthier people, that this will be also a way to spur economic growth. So it's difficult for many people to watch China have lower growth rates, but we feel that they're doing it in a way that's very much with a tremendous awareness of what they're trying to accomplish.
Thank you very much. And we'll be putting out a transcript later today for you. Thank you.
Monday night on The Communicators, three members of Congress talk about their technology legislation.
Back in 2012, we passed a law that makes it possible for the major broadcasters to give back some of their spectrum that they've had. It gives the FCC the authority to repackage spectrum and reallocate it. Under current law, the low-power television industry, they are granted licenses, but those licenses are subject to availability of spectrum in the particular marketplace.
What I am concerned about, however, is an improper call for a kill switch on somebody's phone. If some government entity or an individual, you know, decides that they want to cut your phone off and it's your phone, I think that you ought to have some protection. And so what this bill says is that you certainly can ask your carrier to cut your phone off. If you're the primary person that uses the phone, even if you're not the contract owner, you can ask that the phone be cut off. Or if you're a government entity or a law enforcement agency, in order to cut that phone off, you have to go and get a court order to do so.
Spoofing is very bad behavior where those who are fraudulent try to trick the public and to get information from the public, for example, a Social Security number or tax information, and this is a growing problem in America. particularly among senior citizens.
Republican Representative Joe Barton from Texas, Morgan Griffith of Virginia, and Leonard Lance from New Jersey. Monday night at 8 Eastern on The Communicators on C-SPAN 2.
Next, Q&A with Robert Timberg, author and Vietnam veteran. Then British Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg speaks at the Liberal Democratic Party's annual conference. After that, a discussion on Washington politics and bipartisanship with former Senate leaders Trent Lott of Mississippi and Tom Daschle of South Dakota.
This week on Q&A, our guest is Robert Timberg, journalist and author of Blue Eyed Boy, a memoir. In 1967, he was a Marine just 13 days away from coming home when his vehicle struck a North Vietnamese landmine and changed his life forever. He talks about the impact of the experience, the 35 surgeries he's had, his thoughts on the Vietnam War, and how he physically and emotionally rebuilt himself and his career following the explosion.
Bob Timberg, and the acknowledgments for your book. You say, my son Craig bullied me into writing it. If not for him, it would not exist. And we're talking about this book, Blue Eyed Boy.
Well, you know, that's true. I mean, I had never really had a desire to write this book. People had asked me over the years, you know, is there, you know, why don't you write it? And I said, well, I don't need to get into that. And I think they felt that I was concerned about, you know, afterflash, you know, just being, you know, too hard, dredging up those emotions would be too heavy. And it just was, I didn't think at that point, you know, years ago, that I had anything to say that was in any way particularly inspirational. There had been a lot of books written by veterans who had been wounded. And, you know, it was just sort of nothing to do. But Craig is, just kept pushing. Craig is, as you may know, is a reporter for the Washington Post, and is, ever since he was a little kid, I mean, he just couldn't, you know, if he got his something, he started wanting to do something, he just drove you nuts until he said, okay, go ahead and do it. Well, he was pushing me, and I said, Craig, don't want to do it. I don't want to do it. And then we sort of started talking about, you know, that this is if you're ever going to do it, this is the time. I mean, we look at the country. It's like everything's come back around. I mean, we have these deep divisions over two wars. We have, you know, troops coming back, you know, terribly wounded. And, you know, it's, he said, maybe you have something to say about that. And I said, well, maybe I don't. And he said, well, try. Right? So I did. I thought about it, and he was absolutely right. I mean, I was hoping, with this book, to write something that would, number one, show people what the cost of combat really is. But number two, I think it was sort of aimed at one of the audiences, at least, with men and women who were coming back in seriously, you know, seriously bad shape, who'd lost limbs, had lost skin, who had lost all sorts of things. And I thought, well, you know, maybe this book will give them something to hang on to, the sense that, you know, with a little luck, some grit, some people that care about you, you can really put your life back together. Not exactly the way it was going to be, but in a way that, to use a phrase of Craig's, authentically your own.
Let me show you some video. We last talked about your book, Nightingale Song, 19 years ago. Here's you on this program at that time.
What I did was, to a large extent, I felt that sort of the anger and hostility that many of my peers and comrades felt. And my sense was, you know, I don't think it's good for me. It's not mentally and psychologically good for me to be part of that. And to an extent, I really unplugged from old networks, and I just, and I went off, and I became a reporter, and that's what I, up until a few months ago when I became an editor, I was a reporter for a quarter century, and that's how I viewed myself, is how I view myself today. And going and working on this book was like I plugged back into these old networks, and it became a kind of fascinating journey of rediscovery. But, you know, up until the time that I set off to work on this book, I didn't talk about Vietnam.
We'll get back to that time. And as a matter of fact, we didn't talk much about anything that's in this book, but I do want to continue on in your acknowledgments. The other essential person was my first wife, Jane Timberg. Many of the experiences that I describe in this book occurred more than five decades ago, and it was only through Jane's help that I was able to recreate them in some detail. She allowed me to interview her more than 10 times. Your ex-wife, Jane. How did that happen, and what was that experience like?
I took her to lunch. No, Jane has always been, we've always been friends. There was probably a period shortly after we separated that things were rough, but we came back together again, probably over, we had three kids together, and we've been friends ever since. Plus she lives not far from me, and she's remarried as of, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago. And, you know, she's just a truly good person. I mean, she and her husband Lee, who's a lawyer here in Washington, I mean, they invite me over for dinner on holidays and stuff like that, and they're not that far away. And, you know, sometimes you just run into good people, and it was my great good fortune to sort of stumble into Janie one day at a silly dance at the Naval Academy. And, you know, she did it. I mean, without her, I couldn't have made it through.
What did you learn from those 10 interviews that made the biggest impact on you?
Well, you know, there were certain things I didn't know. And probably the thing that was the hardest thing for me to deal with was the fact that people thought, because of my disfigurement, that Janie had effectively threw me out, just couldn't take it anymore, and as a consequence of that, people started cutting her off, cutting her dead, thinking that, you know, you did this to Bob, which nothing could be further from the truth. And for a long time, it was only a few years later when she realized what was happening. Initially, she just noticed that old friends weren't calling anymore, or they seemed to be busy when she called them. And it was only, I think it was 5, 6, maybe 10 years later that someone said, well, you know, what happened was we thought you had thrown Bob out.
What were the years you were married?
We were married in 65, and we were divorced in, I guess, 71.
Let me read one more from the acknowledgments.
Sure.
Kelly Andrews, my second wife, and sadly my second ex-wife, was another blessing. A fine editor, she read and critiqued much of the book, often finding holes in the narrative and identifying sections that were dull, overwritten, or more than the reader needed to know. What happened to Kelly Andrews, and how did you, are you still in touch with her?
Yes, I am, actually. Yes, I am. And Kelly is, she was in the federal government for 30 years or whatever, and she was a senior official in both the Department of Labor and the Department of Transportation. And for a time years earlier, she was... She was Senator Jacob Javits' legislative assistant. So, I mean, Kelly knew Washington, and, you know, we met up at Harvard. I was going to Washington and knew nothing about it other than every time I came here, I wound up in some sort of circle and I was being spun off into space. I just was lost. And Kelly just said, you know, she just knew it all. She knew more. She didn't just know the Whitehurst Freeway. She knew people, and she knew how this city worked. And she was, beautiful, which I think, you know, I think I put in there. I think people probably thought I had something on her, you know. But I didn't, you know. She was just.
And when were you married, and how long, and when did you get divorced?
We got married, I guess, around 73, something like that. And we were divorced, I think it was last year, the year before. I don't know. It just sort of dragged out. I mean, it was like, it finally, you know, we were separated, and it just finally got to the point where you just had to do it.
And you had how many children with her?
Just one.
How old is he?
Sam is... He's 29 now. Sam was, you know, of my four kids, I had three with Janie. The three kids with Janie were all really brainy kids. And I don't want to diminish Sam's braininess, because he's pretty bright too, but Sam was the jock in the family. And, you know, he was fun. I mean, he was a terrific baseball player, an all-county center fielder, captain of the baseball team, played hockey, And Sam is, to this day, the sunniest person I've ever known. It's just, you just are happy to be with him.
I want to show up before and after. Here's a picture of you writing either a letter home or an after-action report. I wrote lots of letters home, lots of after-action reports, too. What year did you graduate from the Naval Academy, and when was this picture taken?
I graduated from the Naval Academy in 1964, which you may realize that very shortly I'll be celebrating the 50th anniversary of my class graduating. We are having our 50th reunion later this month. That picture was probably taken in 66.
Here is a picture of you after your accident.
Can I just add one thing? I mean, this is something that people, it's easy to fall into, but it wasn't an accident. Those guys were trying to kill me. It wasn't like I just wandered into something. I mean, you know.
How long did you think about putting this picture in?
I didn't think about it at all. That's the one with me writing the...
No, it's the one of you with after your disfigurement.
Oh, I thought about it a while, and my editor thought about it a while, and I came to the conclusion that, and I think we mutually agreed, that you can't hold off. I mean, you're writing about this, you got to, you know, I mean, I have a million pictures like that, some worse, but it just seemed to me that if I was a reader, I would feel like the author was holding out on me by not showing something that was central to the story, which is what happened to him.
Go back to the beginning. What was the date, and where were you?
The date I was wounded? It was January 18th, 1967.
Where were you?
I was southwest of a city in South Vietnam called Da Nang.
What service were you in?
I was a Marine. I am a Marine. Marines are always Marines.
No such thing as an ex-Marine.
No, no.
What was your job there?
I was the executive officer of a company, an anti-tank company, which was an odd kind of unit, since the bad guys didn't have any tanks. So we did a lot of convoy duty, a lot of close combat support. But anyway, that was my job. I tried to get out of it. All Marine officers go through the basic school at Quantico, and, you know, they get orders, and I got orders to Camp Pendleton, the 1st Marine Division, And I got out there, and they said, "And okay, Lieutenant, you're going to the 1st Anti-Tank Battalion." And I said, hold it. No. I'm an infantry officer. I don't know tanks. I don't, And I said, Lieutenant, just go. So then I got to my battalion commander, my new battalion commander, and I did the same thing. I said, sir, I only learned to drive a car. I'm from New York City. I only learned to drive a car about a year ago. I mean, I don't know anything about vehicles and tanks. I don't even know how to check the oil in my car. I don't even know where that dipstick is. He said, Lieutenant, the Marine Corps sent you here for a reason. I don't know what the hell it is, but you're here and you're going to stay. So I did.
Second lieutenant or first lieutenant?
I was a second lieutenant. I was just out of basic school.
And how many days did you have left before you were going to be coming home?
When I was wounded?
Yes, sir.
I had 13 days. 13.
When you think back to the moment, explain what the situation was. What do you remember?
Well, I remember, the reason I was out there was the Marine Corps is very, wants the troops to be paid every 2 weeks. And if they're, in the barracks, you go and pay them in the barracks. And if they're out in the boonies, you go out in the boonies and pay them. And unless they're under fire, you pay them. And, well, within our company, five officers, company commander, the XO, which was me, and then three platoon leaders. And we took turns, everyone except the captain, the company commander, we took turns paying. And I was pay officer that day, but not because it was my turn. It was not my turn. I was going to, I was so close to the end of my tour. I was going to go to Okinawa on R&R that day and price or buy stereo equipment, right? And look for some pearls for Janie, my wife. But, it turned out that the lieutenant, the platoon leader who was supposed to be pay officer, there was something going on. And, I couldn't argue. I mean, this is a war. I can't say, stop fighting. I want to go and look at, whether I want a teak, a tuner, or a Kenwood. Right? So, he did what he had to do, and the job of pay officer that day fell to me. And so that's what I was doing. I was riding on a vehicle with a little bag, little brown canvas bag filled with military payment certificates, which are what pass for money out there, riding on a tracked vehicle called an Amtrak. And we were heading out, it was me and a few other guys heading toward this platoon position, and we hit a landmine and everything just blew.
What do you remember after that?
In the immediate aftermath, I remember the blast, and I remember seeing flames, and then I went out, and then I just conked out. But I don't think I was out that long because I was blown off the Amtrak, and I was lying on the ground, and there was a corpsman shaking me and saying, Lieutenant, are you okay? And I was, or at least I thought I was, because I said, what? He said, look, we hit a mine. You got it pretty bad, but it's going to be okay. I said, fine. And then my sergeant came over and he said, how you doing, Lieutenant? And I said, hold it, Sergeant. We need a perimeter defense out here because basic infantry tactics is when you have an obstacle like a landmine and someone hits it and everybody's running around like a chicken with their head cut off. That's when you just cut them all down, when they're all disorganized, and it's called covering an obstacle by fire. And I said, get a perimeter defense out. We don't want to be sitting here like sitting ducks. And like any good Marine sergeant, he said, well, Lieutenant, I already did that. So... never underestimate the ingenuity of you know, enlisted Marines.
What happened next?
Well, I was still lying there, you know. I mean, and Corman said, you know, are you in pain? I said, well, yeah, some, but I mean, it's not horrible. And he said, well, I can't give you any pain medication. You have essentially a head wound, and we just can't do it. I said, fine, you know, don't worry about it. And he said, the chopper's going to be here very shortly. And a helicopter came in, and I was, you know, they carried me to the helicopter, put me on, and I was, the chopper took me back to this field hospital not that far from Da Nang called, it was actually near something called Monkey Mountain. And, as I was being, you know, they had, when the chopper landed, people grabbed the stretcher I was on and started running with it and running into the hospital. And there was a doctor there, or two or three doctors, and they said, you know, Lieutenant, we think you've either swallowed some fumes or you've swallowed some flames. We have to open your throat. We have to let you to make sure you can breathe, and we're going to have to put in an airway, which meant, and they said, which means we're going to have to cut into your throat, and we probably can't do it with much anesthesia. We'll try, but it's probably not going to work that way. And they just said they just cut. And the next thing I knew, the knife was going across my throat, and like any good Marine, I passed out.
Right. For how long?
God only knows. I mean, when I woke up, I had a tube in my throat, and you know, it was done. That was over with. I mean, I just had the tube for about a month, though. That was sort of horrible because it kept getting filled up with gunk, and they had to run a tube down the tube to suction out the gunk to keep me from drowning in my own gunk. Right?
Where did you spend that month?
I spent it in that hospital, in Da Nang. I mean,
when did they transfer you?
Da Nang was, so you know, Da Nang was a city. Marines were never in a city. We were out somewhere, and they said, well, where are you? Well, we're sort of near Da Nang. So that's when we said we were in Da Nang. That's where we were. We were out in the boonies somewhere. But that hospital, you know, that they had set up was pretty formidable, and I can remember being there probably 3 weeks. I'm not sure now.
Where'd you go next?
I went briefly to Clark Air Force Base, but I was basically a transshipment point to move me from Vietnam up to Japan, where they needed to do some more surgery. I wasn't really aware of it, but there was, I was probably potentially going to die. They weren't ready to send me home, and they wanted to, I think they needed to stabilize my condition. And up in Japan, it was an army hospital. It was a really good one. They did some skin grafting. They did stuff to sort of avoid infection, and I was there easily 3 weeks, a month.
What's the story of your wife, Janie, at the time, coming to Japan?
Well, Janie got notified. She was teaching, and some officers came to her school and told her that I had been wounded. And they didn't have any details. They just knew that there had been some burns. And they said, you know, don't call us. We'll keep you informed. Well, they didn't keep her informed. And you know, she tried to run me down. And she'd call people. Someone would say, well, I think he's in I think he's in Yokosuka. And she, Yokosuka, Japan, and she called there and asked for the, you know, the doctor that's treating Lieutenant Robert Timberg, and she was told they didn't know any Lieutenant Robert Timberg. I was lost for all intents and purposes. I mean, I wasn't like out on the street. I was somewhere being treated, but the people that needed to know where I was, like the Marine hierarchy, my wife, my father. And the way it got straightened out was my father, who is like, well, I mean, he's passed on, but, you know, he had lots of quirks. And one of them was that he was, you know, he was a Jewish vaudevillian, you know, and he was also a wonderful composer. But he was also a Christian Scientist. But not exactly a great Christian Scientist. He wanted to be one. But, you know, so the way he dealt with the idea of, you know, medicine and doctors is he would take doctors out to dinner or at Christmas give them presents. It was like he was warding off bad stuff. And so when I was sent to Vietnam, he tried something similar. He was living in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and there was a Marine Corps recruiting group there. I guess it was like four or five Marines, something like that. And my father became friends with them and take them out to lunch and stuff like that. And I'm sure he was probably devastated when he found out I was wounded and all those lunches had gone to waste. But actually, they didn't, because when no one could find me, he went there and said to those guys, please find my son. And they found me the next day.
Now, there was a pay issue in the middle of all that.
Oh, the pay issue was after, where was I when the pay issue?
You weren't getting paid.
Oh, yeah. By then I was in San Diego, though. I was not getting paid, but I wasn't aware that I wasn't getting paid. It was something that was not on my radar.
Len Ketchum, who was he? Who is he? And what impact did he have on your life?
Other than, you know, Janie, my first wife, Len Ketchum was probably the person most responsible for my return to, you know, the real world. Lynn was a plastic surgeon, relatively young guy. He, when I first met him, he was a doctor, a lieutenant commander at San Diego Naval Hospital, and he operated on me several times. And years later, when he was out of the service, he operated on me again in Kansas City. I mean, he was just remarkable.
How many operations?
Lynn and I came up with a number of about 35.
How many times were you under anesthesia?
All of those. We didn't count the other stuff. We didn't count the stuff that was local, which wasn't that much. Mostly everything was under general anesthesia.
What was he doing mostly during those operations?
A lot of it was skin grafting, but a lot of it was loosening up stuff. My mouth was like swollen to like the size of a straw, and he did some cutting and pulling and reshaped my mouth and managed to pull some of the stuff that's inside your mouth, the red stuff, out, and formed lips, you know. And so that was one of the kind of things he did, and that was sort of amazing. And I had the scarring that took place had pulled my nostrils up really, really sharply. They had a kind of horsey look, you know. And he managed to release that and somehow bring them down. And I mean, he just did He worked on my eyes, he worked on my ears, he worked on my cheeks, and you know, I don't know what I would have done without him.
How long did it take for you to be in a position where you could go out and look for a job?
Well, Lynn threw me out of the hospital. I mean, I was at a certain point after I'd been there a year, over a year, in San Diego Naval Hospital. He said, "Well, you know, I'm going to discharge you because, you know, we've done all we can do right now. Your skin has got to go through various stages. It's got to, you know, it's going to get tight. It's going to get hard. It's going to soften, but it has to soften. And